Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Okay. Welcome back to Docs Who Lift podcast. We have our first guests on, and we actually made this a big party because we have...
It's a round table.
Four extra guests instead of just me and my brother going back and forth. We're going to have four other people, and I'm going to let my brother introduce these people. But first, this podcast is all about continuous glucose monitors, CGMs. You may have seen some about this, maybe ads, where people are saying you need to buy this thing because it's going to help you do whatever you want in life and get ripped and healthy and live forever. And then you might have heard people just say, no, they're worthless. You shouldn't use them at all. So we're going to get all into that. So Dr. Carl,
all right,
who's not the greatest, who I usually say is the greatest endocrinologist, but we have some other endocrinologists, so I can't say that because I have no idea if he's actually that good. So anyway, if you could introduce your friends here, colleagues, because I don't really know who the hell they are. So anyway.
All right. Thank you. So Dr. Brett Ginto. He was a fellow with me at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, Bethesda, Maryland. We happen to have really what we would who we would consider one of the greatest endocrinologists of all time, who was really a pioneer in continuous glucose monitoring, Dr. Robert Vigursky. And then, Brett, you went on to finish your military career, and now you're still in the reserves, huh? You're still a major, I guess. And you're now an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So he's here to talk about it. He's one of the original Docs Who Lift. Look, he even has a shirt on for those of you who are seeing the video. And Dr. Artie Tangadu is from Texas, and she's an endocrinologist. And like Spencer, she is a leader in telemedicine. She provides telemedicine endocrine services to all of Texas. And then I brought in a couple special guests with me today. I have an all-star cast of dietitians who are also my diabetes educators, and Brianna Ray and Michelle Telemac are awesome diabetes educators, dietitians, and they are like my life source for getting into the weeds of the technology, the diabetes technology we have, and that includes these continuous glucose monitors. So I guess, you know, Brett, I want to ask you first, and remember, most of the people listening to this are probably patients and those interested in their health and wellness, but maybe other clinicians, maybe primary care, Spencer's family practice. And so, you know, first of all, what the heck are continuous glucose monitors? And what kind of different ones do we have available to us?
Yeah. So, hey, thanks all of you for having me this afternoon. Continuous glucose monitors are these newer technological devices that allow us to, and our patients, to check their sugar levels, their glucose levels more continuously, as the name implies. So instead of just a random finger stick, where they have to poke their finger every time they want to know one number, they can wear a device that can last for up to a small device, and they're pretty easy to put on, easy to apply. And they can wear them for 7 to 14 days, typically 10 to 14 days long. And they can check their sugars any time of the day they want to know it. Basically, they can these little devices can check your blood sugars anywhere between 1 and 5 or 15 minutes. And it's really convenient to use. Instead of having to pick your finger to know one number, you can kind of look at your blood sugar over the trace of 24 hours or continuously over 2 weeks, monthly, in these different time frames. So they're really convenient tools, and they're newer technology. They work with some smartphones, so that way you can just walks around with their smartphone, so you won't really leave home while you're wearing a sensor and a smartphone and kind of know what your blood sugars are at any given time, which is really nice. So that's kind of in a nutshell. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about, Brie and Michelle, you guys are in the weeds. Tell me, and especially for patients, the difference between real-time CGM, we have the intermittently scanned CGMs, and you guys you guys can say brands. We don't want to endorse any brands, but, you know, we can talk about pros and cons and some patient things. And then we also have professional, or we also call them blinded CGM that we've used quite a bit. And the differences of these may be necessary when we discuss the pros and cons and the cost effectiveness when patients want to use them. Just quickly, we don't have to get too crazy with it, but the basics.
So in general, there's a Libre that will do a continuous glucose monitor, and you can use your phone as your device to read. There's a Libre 2 that will show you your alarms and alerts. But with the Libre system, you have to scan it in order to get data. So that's how that one works. But it does, like, if you scan it at 8 o'clock and then scan it again at 10 o'clock, it will backtrack and tell you what your sugars were within that period of time. So you have to scan it every 8 hours in order to get data every 5 minutes, 24 hours a day. And you wear that for 14 days. Whereas if you wear a Dexcom, you wear it for 10 days and you don't have to scan it. You just automatically get your data, every 5 minutes. So it's helping people be more compliant and, not have to stop and get their meter and check their blood sugar. It's putting their blood sugars kind of right at their fingertips without poking them.
Yeah. And there is one other real-time continuous glucose monitor that I know we don't use it that much, but it is available from Medtronic. It's just not used that much standalone on its own other than with its own pump, but we don't need to get in too much into that. I don't know. Bree, do you have any experience with that one? Or Artie, does anybody have experience with that one? I don't use it a lot other than in the integrated Medtronic, hybrid closed loop pump system. So
yeah, we really only use it with the closed hybrid loop system with Medtronic. We don't use the Guardian sensor on its own just because we have found that the Dexcom and the Freestyle Libre systems are much more user friendly and the patients like them better, because with the Guardian sensor, they have to calibrate. They still have to poke their finger every 12 hours. And where with the Freestyle Libres and the Dexcom, the only time they have to poke their fingers are to confirm that they're having low blood sugars if they're being alarmed that they are or having symptoms of low blood sugars. So the patients definitely have much more they preference of the Freestyle Libres and the Dexcom compared to the Guardian sensors. So that's kind of the 2 cents on that. But
what are the indications here? Is that where you're going to get into? You're going to get into who's supposed to be using these?
Yeah, that's the next step. So Artie, tell us about, the most obvious group of people who really, really benefit from continuous glucose monitoring based upon data that goes back before we even had continuous glucose monitoring are people with type 1 diabetes, because they have to have really intensive insulin replacement therapy, basal, we call it the long-acting insulin, and bolus therapy. So Artie, can you tell us just your one-liner or whatever, quick background on why these are so beneficial for people with type 1 diabetes on intensive insulin therapy?
So we have great data that shows that CGMs improve patient engagement and empowerment, or not CGMs, but increased blood sugar checks. So that's one soft outcome that we can't really minimize the importance of. But these devices also improve time in range and, most more importantly, decrease hypoglycemia, which can be very, very dangerous in our patients with type 1. And so I think most of us agree that CGM are very, very helpful, and the data supports their use in type 1.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they improve average sugar levels with less hypoglycemia and all that stuff. The controversy recently, apparently, Artie, tell us what people have been saying about people with type 2 diabetes, and we'll get into the spectrum of dysglycemia, who needs insulin and whatnot, because most of our people with diabetes who have abnormal sugars have type 2 diabetes in some form, and everyone's different.
Right. So I just learned that there was a controversy over use of CGM in patients with type 2 last night, actually. So there is a physician who has a very large social media following and a popular podcast that generally I think we love because it myth busts a lot of things, even in the endocrinology space. But she told me that she's bringing someone on who is a non-clinician PhD who studies evidence-based medicine. And basically the premise of that podcast will be that the data doesn't support use of CGM in type 2 diabetes, which as endocrinologists, I think most of us would disagree.
Yeah. And I'll tell you right up front for anybody listening to this, the evidence-based guidelines that we have available with the experts who have studied and published the data on continuous glucose monitoring recommend at maybe weaker strengths the use of some form of continuous glucose monitoring in type 2 diabetes, depending on the severity of their disease, which in this case is based upon, you know, what their hyperglycemic situation is, how much insulin they need. I think what I think some people forget is that there are people with type 2 diabetes, as much as we try not to do this, there are people who just require basal bolus insulin, just like people with type 1 diabetes. Their pancreas ultimately fails. They, you know, depending on what kind of medicines they can be on, how they've done, their genetics and all that stuff, and they need to be on basal bolus insulin therapy, whether it's basal plus some little bit here and there. And I can't imagine, because that's a much stronger recommendation from American Diabetes Association, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, and the Endocrine Society guidelines that address these issues, because they get pretty much the same obvious outcome data as those with type 1 diabetes: better average sugars, more time in the safe range, less hypoglycemia. So I feel like maybe these people forgot about those people right off the bat. What do you say, Dr. Ginto?
So I think it's important, I think you're getting to this, Casey, to separate, you know, when you say type 2 diabetes overall, I mean, that's a lot of people. It's a big population.
That's a lot of people.
and are we talking about CGM benefiting all of type 2 diabetes, or at least a subgroup? Because we know that they are approved for folks who are taking, at least they're better covered in terms of insurance coverage for folks who are with diabetes who take multiple daily doses of insulin a day. So I think I just wanted to clarify for people who are listening, you know, who's using these in type 2 diabetes, and do those patients get benefit from it? The people who are taking basal bolus regimens of insulin, aka multiple daily uses, like three or more shots of insulin per day.
Yeah. Could you guys go over just hypoglycemia? Why is it bad? I mean, I know why it's bad, but there's clear data of why it's more than just getting a low blood sugar and not feeling good. Maybe you can just explain why it's dangerous over long term.
Yeah, so hypoglycemia is not just about we don't want a patient to have a low blood sugar because we don't like that number, right? Hypoglycemia is highly dangerous. And so when a patient is having hypoglycemia, if they repeatedly have hypoglycemia, they develop what we call hypoglycemia unawareness, which is a situation where they will not have those adrenergic symptoms that we typically associate with hypoglycemia, like clamminess, shaking, tunnel vision, hunger, and they can get to a place where they will have such a profound low, like 20s, 30s, without any symptoms, when they develop neuroglycopenic symptoms, where your brain cells don't have enough sugar to work. And so patients can die from having a low that is that low, and they can also pass out. They can have really, really severe effects of hypoglycemia. So hypoglycemia is a very, very dangerous situation. And in endocrinology, you know, we're trained to, if there's hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia, knock out the hypoglycemia first and then address the hyperglycemia, because hypoglycemia is so acutely dangerous.
So acutely dangerous. And then over time, though, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, this is where a lot of the data show that over time there's probably increased mortality with more of these events.
Yeah.
Over time, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yep. So very dangerous. And this is where CGMs come into play to hopefully prevent that. Not just the hyperglycemia, as you said. Hypoglycemia is more important.
Yeah, really anybody on insulin, if they really need it, should really, really, really should have a continuous glucose monitor. Some people with type 2 diabetes are only on basal insulin. So that's like your fasting insulin that you have to control your fasting glucose. And sometimes, you know, historically, when we just used a finger stick here and there, you don't know what's actually happening overnight while you're fasting, right? I see Bree and Michelle nodding their heads. They've had patients who found out that they were having hypoglycemia overnight because they had too much basal insulin while we're trying to help them oftentimes reduce their insulin, by the way, which continuous glucose monitors help us do.
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, I think another benefit of CGM that you kind of alluded to is that we can now aggressively titrate medications. You know, we can see patients getting on an improved insulin regimen or a general overall medication regimen very, very quickly because we're not sitting around and waiting 3 months for an A1C. We're seeing real-time blood sugar, and we can more safely adjust medications quickly. Time is money in diabetes, right? Complications occur over time. So if we can buy back time with improved blood sugars to reduce complications, I think that's huge for diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2.
Yeah. And I'm going to circle back to both you and Spencer as telemedicine experts, and we do a lot of this now, and how useful this is for virtual medicine when we don't even have to see patients in the clinic. Bree and Michelle have experienced some finding many patients on their own that they have to tell us about who have hypoglycemia overnight just on basal insulin plus their other medications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like how you were saying, Artie, like with the ability to see those trends, that 24-hour period, we're able to see, you know, if people are having low blood sugars overnight and or people that are having hypoglycemia unawareness and aren't waking up, they're with these CGMs, they're being alerted like you're having a low blood sugar, it's waking them up. So safety wise, it's significantly improved that, but also, like you said earlier, like time and range as well. And so it just brings such this awareness and much more precise medication regimen because we're able to see how their blood sugars are affected over that 24-hour period course.
Could you guys explain time and range a little bit? I know you've mentioned a few times, but you're talking endocrine lingo, and I know there's people listening that are like, "What the hell are you talking about?"
Yeah, I was gonna try to do that sometime in the beginning. There is so, and we can post this, but if you look at the ACE, there's all these guidelines that we talk about. The ACE 2019.
Just brief, very simple. What is
so
time and range?
Time and range, generally for the people we're talking about, is the amount of time, the percent of time you spend between 70 milligrams per deciliter and 180 milligrams per deciliter. There are some nuances and goals for people who have, who are pregnant. That's kind of the most obvious nuance. So those need to be slightly tighter, a little bit more aggressive. Certainly we want to reduce the time below range, which is the hypoglycemia, because that's the most dangerous. So these are ways we can look at this and help people beyond just a hemoglobin A1C. I was going to come back to that and talk about how, you know, a continuous glucose monitor really has made a hemoglobin A1C sort of obsolete. An A1C is great for what it is. It's an average blood sugar that over 3 months, because that's how long red blood cells live. And but there are lots of things that cause problems to A1Cs. They're not always totally accurate. People with different types of anemias and chronic kidney disease and pregnancy, they don't, you know, they screw up that A1C, and then there's individual variability. But a continuous glucose monitor just tells us what the average sugar is. And in fact, we get something out of it. Now they have to call it a glucose management indicator that really is an estimated A1C because everyone's so used to the A1C, but it actually is what it is. And then you get all that, you get the patterns, okay? We get to see the daily average patterns of people's glycemic patterns and that time in range, the time below range, and all that stuff. Anything else you guys like to look at?
I would say in general, you can have a lot of high blood sugars and low blood sugars, and your average A1C looks great, but it is not great. So this is totally telling us what's going on and really which insulin to adjust. You know, are they having post-meal highs or post-meal lows or fasting or all night long? So it really helps us adjust medications safely.
So from a purely evidence-based standpoint, so if we have someone, a PhD, I don't know who it is, whatever, someone that's going to come in and look at the data, do we have clear data that in type 2 diabetes with those who are on insulin, there's a clear benefit? Do we have that data, or is it expert opinion in the ADA and expert opinion in these?
Yeah. So here, I'll just read down these. So from the ACE 2019 guideline on this. So grade A with best evidence level 1, it's recommended for pregnant women with type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes who are treated with intensive insulin therapy. Grade A, best evidence level 1, it's recommended for women with gestational diabetes on insulin therapy. And that's where it's so obviously evidence-based. Where it becomes a little bit less obvious, and this is maybe where those people get confused, it may be recommended for women with gestational diabetes who are not on insulin therapy because it can help. Now, the data are mixed, though, because some studies have not shown awesome pregnancy outcomes where others have shown some potential improved outcomes, but it also helps the patient keep their glucoses where we know they need to be to help prevent the adverse pregnancy outcomes. And then grade B, level 1, CGM may be recommended for individuals with type 2 diabetes who are treated with less intensive insulin therapy. And this is where we get into, well, what about those with type 2 diabetes who are maybe not on insulin therapy? Or maybe, because here's the anecdotal part of this is, we can get them off of insulin therapy if their pancreas still works and we're helping them with their diet and all that stuff. It doesn't mean you have to replace your berries with bacon, which is, I think, what some people are maybe worried about, you know, going from a very nice, healthy diet that might have some sugar excursions from healthy food to, like, you know, unhealthy sources of keto. But those things don't have to happen. What do you guys think of that? This is where the data are mixed. Because again, even within that spectrum of people with type 2 diabetes who don't need insulin or who are able to get off of insulin, there are certainly people who may not get a huge benefit from this, depending on how it's used.
So from a purely evidence-based standpoint, we don't have that RCT or GTFO type of data right now that says, yes, use CGMs in those with type 2 diabetes without insulin use. But we have multiple practitioners here who do it.
Yeah, well, we have data. We have randomized controlled trials. They're just not huge, robust, with absolute hard outcomes necessarily.
And the outcomes are what? Is there a decrease in glycemia? Is there improvement?
So there's improved average A1C, which matters, you know, A1C or the average sugars.
Yeah.
It matters for long term. We have data for improved quality of life for patients. And there's some even cost effectiveness data. But I think that usually includes maybe some insulin, maybe not intensive insulin. But for example, there was a study, I'm looking at it right now in the Journal of from the Endocrine Society from just a year and a half ago, where, and this is where some of the studies didn't do it right. They didn't necessarily combine the education from, say, our dietitians to go along with the real-time continuous glucose monitor or even the professional one where they're blinded and they don't know what's happening to change their lifestyle. So this was a randomized controlled trial that it reduced their need for diabetes medications with a statistically significant value. It improved their diabetes knowledge, their quality of life, reduced their diabetes distress, and tended to, I don't know how they studied this, more empowerment without increasing dietary fat, lipids, or any hypoglycemia. And so that was combined with an educational component to use with their continuous glucose monitor. So, you know, I think, and this has been studied in prediabetes. Dr. Vigursky, Brett, he was studying this with prediabetes when we first got to fellowship, and it was a little it wasn't working, and it seemed like it was because the patients didn't have the education to go along with their continuous glucose monitor so that they could make the appropriate adjustments. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think during that time they were looking at things like behavioral modifications from just the being able to see, having the insight into your own blood sugar triggers and patterns, you know. I think patients gain a lot of benefit from being able to see what triggers higher blood sugars and also what triggers lower blood sugars. And so sometimes I tell them, hey, look at those as well, because you might be able to use that as a take advantage of that to help you lower your blood sugars. Maybe that's that 5 or 10 minute walk after you have a meal. Maybe it's that, you know, big glass of water sometimes that helps to maybe you're a little dehydrated, it makes the blood sugars look a little higher. So there's a lot of these little things that they get a lot of insight from. And so I think what he was doing there is looking at the psychology of folks with diabetes, which I think is a really important aspect. And I think patient preference and the psychology. I think we talked a little bit about hypoglycemia, so I'm just going to take a second to talk about it. But a lot of patients will have a lot of fear and anxiety about lows. When they've been that low, they never want to be that low ever again. And they wouldn't mind paying a little more out of pocket for a special device, something that's small, that they can wear, that gives them an extra layer of feeling secure and safe. And I don't blame them to have that feeling of safety in terms of fear and anxiety. So I think there's a lot to go into the psychology of diabetes that is being somewhat, not discounted, but I think it's a really big conversation to have. It's not just about A1C, time and range, decreased complications, costs, but also in there is the patient. And I think it's a really important thing to take into account.
Yeah, quality of life. Now, Artie, after your conversation last night with our friend, you went back and you kind of reviewed the literature on type 2 diabetes and the use of continuous glucose monitor, as did I, because I feel like I know this stuff, but I went back and reviewed. I was like, are we crazy? Okay, so what are your some bullet points for the benefits in type 2 diabetes that are evidence-based? Because we have the lots of trials.
Yeah. So sorry, I missed some of this because I got disconnected. But so forgive me if I repeat some of the things that were already said. But so yeah, I looked through our ADA standards of care in diabetes, which is a very important piece of literature that helps guide us as far as diabetes care, and it's something that's updated every year. And there is a recommendation under the diabetes technology section that recommends that CGM should be offered to patients with diabetes. It does not specify that this is type 1 or type 2 or pancreatogenic or anything. It just says diabetes in general. CGM should be offered in patients who are on MDI and on CSII, so continuous subcutaneous insulin infusion and multiple daily injections. So, you know, I think a big issue was that, well, your guidelines aren't recommending it. So if it hasn't made it to the guidelines, why are we using it so much in type 2? And I would say that if they're saying it should be offered, I think that's a recommendation that it should be offered.
Don't the ADA standards also suggest the use of professional or intermittent use of real time or intermittently scanned CGM to help identify and correcting patterns, I'm kind of quoting this, of hypoglycemia, and improving A1C yeah. levels in people with diabetes on non-insulin as well as basal insulin regimen. So they do have that section in there, and that's consistent with the Endocrine Society and the ACE guideline too that I just mentioned. That's, you know, very evidence based.
Yeah, and then so I looked up the articles that are cited in that section of the ADA standards of care, and we do have. I mean, they're not huge, massive studies, but we do have statistically significant A1C reduction with CGM in type 2 diabetes. And you know, I think people who aren't endocrinologists or who aren't in this space forget the importance of small changes in A1C. Like a 1% reduction in A1C is huge. You know, when we go from complication risk that increases linearly until we hit A1C of 9, and then the complication risk goes up exponentially, right? And so if we are reducing a patient's A1C by 1% with an intervention that has no harm, we could be reducing complication risk tremendously. So I think that, you know, if we're looking at data in a vacuum without an understanding of the clinical situation and the implications of certain outcomes, then sure, it may not sound meaningful. But for those of us in this room, we know what those outcomes mean, and we know how tremendously they can affect patients. There was also one study on patient motivation and engagement with lifestyle intervention that showed some improvement there, which I think most of us probably see clinically as well. So there was evidence to support, you know, are these robust enough studies to merit, you know, whoever is creating this podcast, ideals, I guess perhaps not, but we do have evidence to support use. And then I think also, we can't look at evidence in a vacuum, right? We have to look at it clinically and understand the clinical implications of what we're saying. So I think it's a little bit short-sighted to be interviewing somebody who's never seen a patient with diabetes and never utilized a CGM for the topic of CGM and type 2 diabetes. And, you know, today I posted on social media, you know, those charts that we use for inpatient diabetes in fellowship, like where it's a graph where it's like the time of the blood sugar and you're writing down the specific blood sugar and you're tracking trends to titrate blood sugar. And it's like this meticulous process that we don't learn until endocrinology fellowship. Well, CGM does this for us, right? It makes it so much easier. And that's how expert level diabetes care is delivered. But most people aren't experts. So I can see why it might be hard to understand.
Yeah. And so then I'll take that. And so there's some of the evidence. So, you know, we have some evidence-based guidelines. Yeah, the evidence isn't as strong as for those with type 1 diabetes on multiple doses of insulin. But Bree and Michelle, take, you know, so we have that evidence in type 2 diabetes. Now let's take it to the real world for our patients, because we get referred lots of patients who are struggling with their obesity, their type 2 diabetes. They're already on maybe too much basal insulin, maybe even some other insulin. And then we use some of the, you know, medications that we're familiar with that really more or less treat the pathology of type 2 diabetes. And our favorite thing on Docs Who Live podcast is using it for the lifestyle interventions. And so it's not that you have to suddenly turn into a keto dietary evangelical and eat bacon all day just so you don't get the sugar, the high sugar excursions, we call them. But just give a little example of how you guys and I have taken tons of people off insulin, improved their diet and exercise because they're using their CGM, or maybe we're just looking at the CGM and going over it with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, specifically, kind of going back to the motivation part too, I mean, patients are able to physically see how their body is reacting to either higher carb meals. They say they historically have eaten cereal for breakfast, and they're physically in real time seeing how their blood sugar is affected by that. And they now, after seeing education and working with us dietitians or diabetes educators, you know, educating them and saying like, okay, let's choose maybe a healthier option. Let's lower that carb amount. Let's have some protein added to that. And when they make those changes and then they physically see the improvement in their blood sugars, just gives them so much motivation to like, okay, I can do this and I can keep and I can manage my blood sugars with lifestyle changes, as well as even the effect of like physical activity on their blood sugars. They're able to kind of see, you know, how a positive impact that is in their blood sugar management, that it motivates them to continue to do better and better and better. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to go to a completely keto, you know, type of diet, just more of a, you know, moderate amount of carbs. And they're able to see that positive impact from those, say, not so good, you know, eating habits and patterns or physical inactivity prior. So
yeah, so it helps personalization.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, so I think maybe just out of the sake of time, at some point I wanted to talk about what these little things that we look at in these continuous glucose monitors mean, like the variability and all that stuff, and what the evidence for why we even care. That might have to be a part two, because the one other section of this that we need to get to, Spencer, talk about who's out there pushing everyone, even fit, very glycemically healthy people like athletes, to use continuous glucose monitors. So this is the other extreme. And there are actually doctors out there pushing this too, because there's always these conflicts of interest, by the way. So that's the problem. And so everyone who, you know, those of us on this podcast, we've all worn continuous glucose monitors. We are all metabolically healthy, without any dysglycemia. And we know that we didn't see many changes no matter what we did to ourselves, whether it was from exercise, not eating, or eating tons and tons of sugar, because our physiology works. People with type 2 diabetes, that's not the case. That's where they get the benefit, certainly type 1. So Spencer, what's going on? What's tell us about name names, if you want
to. I wore my CGM and then stress tested it with a pan of brownies and pizza, and it turns out I probably shouldn't do that.
What did it show? How high did you get it?
I don't know. Went up to, I think I got it up to like 180s or something.
Really?
Like that. I don't know.
Oh man. High. Well, all right. So you're not metabolically healthy. Okay. Forget you. I wasn't able to get him that.
I don't know, but Yeah, but that's because you eat salmon all day. You eat salmon all day. You eat salmon. That's all you eat.
Keto for life.
I don't even know if it was correct, because then when I checked it on the, because then it sometimes I was just sitting there and it'd start going up, and then I'd have to replace it. I actually got some free sensors because the rep was like, "Nah, this looks faulty." So I don't even know what was real. I'd check and it looked like it was lower than what the CGM said. That's the other issue. So anyway, here's the thing.
Well, talk about what Peter Attia says.
Yeah, so there's Peter Attia, but there's also, it's not just him, it's just multiple of these biohackers and longevity experts who say everybody needs to wear a continuous glucose monitor and kind of biohack your physiology. And so that's, I think, the other extreme, to where it's like, okay, if somebody doesn't really understand these nuances, then maybe they would appreciate or go for a piece of bacon instead of some blueberries, just from some of these small glucose excursions. And some people might be listening going, okay, that's ridiculous. Nobody would ever think that, except that I get hundreds of these messages per week. I don't want to eat bananas because I got a CGM and it showed my blood sugar went up. I'm like, well, no shit, your blood sugar went up. You just ate carbohydrate. What are you talking about? How high did it go? You know what I mean? So there are people saying this, and it's almost like they're looking for pathology in some individuals. But I can tell you one thing, me stress testing, the reason I brought me up, like eating, I was like trying to eat continually and eating huge things of pizza, and brownies to see if I could stress it. The only time it went super high was like, I think it was the faulty sensor. But I don't need a CGM to tell me not to do that. It doesn't tell you whether you're going to lose weight or not. I think there are other markers that we can look at that you don't need a CGM to understand for weight loss and for insulin sensitivity. Now, if you want to just play around like I did or whoever else, I think it's a good idea. I was talking to Michelle though before this, and she actually felt that I think that everybody should wear it for a couple weeks at first. So I think we could have that discussion that, if you have the good education and want to see your own physiological changes and you pay for it cash, I also, that's another part of it. We don't want insurance. We don't want to bloat insurance companies where some people can't even afford it, who actually need it, who are on insulin, who can't even get their CGM.
Right. That's a huge issue.
We're bloating up insurance by getting it ourselves. And, this kind of this privileged, first world problems. Like I actually bought mine cash because I didn't want to mess with insurance. I'm sure I could have finagled it to where I got insurance to pay for it, but I didn't want to. So I paid, however many $100 for the Dexcom. But I think that's another part of it. So
this goes back, every time we've talked about this, we said, well, what is even normal? So the biggest normal CGM study in people who, were not pregnant, healthy, as far as what, kind of goes as healthy, and that's, also a spectrum of that, people without diabetes, when they just wore it for a couple of weeks, their average glucose, this includes going up and back to normal, by the way, not just fasting, their average glucose was 98 milligrams per deciliter. So pre-diabetes impaired fasting glucose is 100 or above, and glucose intolerance pre-diabetes is if you drink a sugar drink 2 hours later, it goes above 140. So that was their average. The time, remember we talked about the time and range? Well, the time between 70 and 140, which is even tighter, like really normal kind of physiology, was 96%. And remember, these are not perfect, by the way. We didn't even get into the little bit of error that all these different meters have. Nothing's perfect. But 96% of healthy people in that study were between 70 and 140, or at least they were 96% of the time they were between that. And then the glycemic variability issue. So that basically is the standard deviation away from your average. And so it's recommended for people, especially people on insulin, to keep that, it's called a coefficient variation, less than about 36%. So it's basically like a third of your average. Well, these healthy people had a glycemic variability of 17%. They're not going all over the place, and they were just eating normally. And normal diet, we might argue, is not the healthiest diet anyways. And so the fact that this normal cohort had those numbers, I just don't know how you know, very fit, healthy people are going to get much out of it. But I did have the discussion, Brett, with Dr. Vigursky the other day when I was at the ACE conference. And he said, yeah, you know, I don't know, these high intense athletes, you know, these bikers, they're using it. Maybe they can, you know, either anecdotally, like Spencer and I were talking about, anecdotally find a way to say, oh, you know what, I feel better when I take my, you know, dextrose drink when my sugar says this or something. Maybe they can get some data. But boy, you know, people are like concerned about the data, the hard outcome data for type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes. Think about for like high level, intense, very metabolically healthy athletes. I don't know. I'm very skeptical for that.
My coefficient variation, mine was like 14 or something like that. It was very
that's about
low.
Right. Yeah.
Again, I tried to stress test it. I was like trying my best. And it was the only time was maybe when it was faulty and it went up super high. And I was like, okay, I shouldn't eat brownies and pizza.
So I'm very skeptical. And I'll tell you, you guys tell me your experiences. We all have patients who, you know, and not necessarily with this situation, but there are people out there who might get real anxious about this because they see there's, like you said, oh my God, my sugar went up to 110 after a banana. Well, what does that mean? You know, and that's why at some point we need to talk about what do these numbers mean? How do they correlate to long-term disease prognosis? But there are people who I think have a lot of anxiety just from slight changes. What do you guys think of that?
Here's a question. If somebody's normal, if they want to go check it out, which if I don't know, I don't have any problems with people checking it out if they're well informed of what their physiology is. I mean, I did it.
It's their harm.
Although I'm kind of a hypochondriac, so whatever. Could there be harm if you tell them right now? So what would be numbers to look out for? Obviously, the 180 that I had, I was a bit concerned about that, but I was kind of like, I think it was somewhat of an error.
So what's the harm, I guess, in a normal person?
But maybe you should be looking. What if it does go up to, what if you're constantly going up to 180s after normal meals? And then if it comes back down normal, did you have some glucose intolerance and maybe you should, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm pretty lean.
But for those folks, so say they're, you know, someone who is not diagnosed with pre-diabetes or diabetes, they slap one of these things on and they see hyperglycemia or dysglycemia. I mean, I think it just spurs the conversation and say, hey, maybe I should talk to my primary care or and have that conversation about what's going on with these numbers. I think, you know, the cat's out of the bag, so to speak, in terms of this technology, right? It's not going away. CGM technology is here and it's probably going to progress to something even, you know, they're getting smaller, they're getting more easy to put onto to anybody, you know, in terms. So I mean, I think you're dealing with all different types of populations who are going to be using this technology. It clinically was intended for folks with diabetes, pre-diabetes, you know, all these types of people, but you know, they're going to be people like you're talking about who are getting their hands on it, the healthy, the worried well, the healthy folks, the elite athletes, and they're going to be trying to pull all the different triggers, right? I think in terms of elite athletes, I'm not one. I think you guys are more closer to that spectrum. I'm not as medically metabolically healthy as the Nadolskis, okay? But I won't even mention what my CGM numbers look like. They tend to trend a little higher. And actually, funny story, at one dinner, I kind of put my colleagues and my CGM numbers next to each other in a blinded test with my colleagues. And I said, hey, look at these patterns. Tell me who's going to develop diabetes in the next 5-10 years. By the way, it's me. Anyway, so you can just tell by the curves. Anyway. So I think, you know, there's going to be people, these elite athletes who are going to try to find any competitive advantage, you know, and you're right. There's going to be the worried well and the people who are going to be very anxious to see these things. But, you know, it doesn't stop some other companies like Apple or whatever they sell heart rate monitors to everybody, blood pressure cuffs to everybody, all these types of things that you can kind of do DIY yourself at home, Bluetooth technology scales to your phone. You know, it's like, you know, so there's all these types of technology out there.
I don't have a problem with it if people are well informed. Like, again, for myself, I was kind of, it's like for most of my meals, my normal, whatever, a little bit of starch, vegetables, some fruit, and some lean protein, it'd go up to, you know, whatever, 120, something like that. And that's about right. And so like, I could see where it's like some people have their pizza night out, just like I stress tested it, their pizza night, they're drinking whatever. And they can see like this huge excursion to where it's like, that's probably not normal. And again, it has to be studied, but it maybe it deters them from having those kind of
it might And maybe, although, you know, people who are having that probably fit into some sort of screening criteria anyways. You know, we were just talking about, I was talking with one of my other colleagues, how the USPSTF just lowered their age threshold for, you know, screening for diabetes. I'll tell you, you know, in a lot of the guidelines that I've been involved with, you know, we think anybody who has any risk factor, obesity, family history, we should just screen with A1C, maybe 2-hour glucose tolerance testing, fasting glucose, et cetera, to see if you are on the realm of dysglycemia. But Artie, if someone does, you know, want to use a CGM for, you know, elite athlete stuff or random stuff, what, you know, what do you think they should be looking out for? Either clues to, oh my God, I better go get checked out, or if you have any thoughts on, you know, athletes. And again, yeah, we're athletes. I can't figure out how that might be beneficial, but what do you think?
Yeah, so I think, so I have worn a CGM before, and my highest glucose readings were right after I'd go for a run. And so I think we all understand why that is. But
well, the patients might not, so why is that?
Exactly.
Why, the other people might not, so.
Right, so, you know, when you're running, you have, when you have that, you know, intense physical exercise, you may have a surge in something like cortisol or epinephrine or things like that that can raise blood sugar. So I think that when we use CGM on, you know, kind of a broad scale without the oversight of an endocrinologist or someone who's really well versed in it, we do have a potential for risk here. You know, I think the whole issue with type 2 diabetes is that it's low risk, high impact. And so maybe we are using it without the most profound data, but in the general population who does not have dysglycemia, well, there are real risks. And so I'm seeing quite a few patients who are referred for hypoglycemia that doesn't meet Whipple's triad, which is when a patient has a serum glucose that is low and it improves with and they're symptomatic, and the blood sugar improves with eating.
Yeah, she's talking about real low sugars,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, real hypoglycemia. And so, you know, we have people who are thinking that they have hypoglycemia, and they don't really. And this is actually clinically relevant. Like, I had a patient just a couple of weeks ago who was told her whole life, she's wearing a Dexcom, she has type 2 diabetes, but she's told that she has hypoglycemia. And her CGM sometimes reads like 68. She doesn't always have symptoms. And so this woman is eating all the time to try to maintain her blood sugar to normal because she's afraid of this hypoglycemia that's not true hypoglycemia. And at the same time, she's struggling with type 2 diabetes and obesity. And so I think that, you know, we have to use these devices with somebody who understands what the readouts mean. And if you're just kind of a prescription mill for Freestyle Libre, that's not what these patients are getting. And so so I think it can be really dangerous.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dr. Artie. I think if we're going to do these things, I don't think people should just be handing these out and just so people get scared over small little excursions from bananas and go straight up keto because of it. I think if there's good guidance, I think they can be used safely without harm. I do think we shouldn't be utilizing insurance for these, you know, what we consider healthy, normal people who just are kind of interested in their own physiology. I do think it's probably based on what we're talking about. It's obviously good for in type 1 diabetes. I think highly likely good for those with type 2 diabetes on insulin. I think it's probably good for those with type 2 diabetes, regardless to who want to see their what foods cause these profound excursions. The data is not as clear on that, but go ahead.
I think one thing to touch on was that there was this issue with like what the algorithm is preferentially reading for. Like what they were saying is that, well, this uses glycemic index, and I think we all kind of agree that glycemic index does not produce that much meaningful data because, for example, like watermelon will have a higher glycemic index than chocolate cake. And so these devices may not, what people have said is that these devices are utilizing similar sort of information to glycemic or providing similar sort of information as glycemic index and doesn't really tell you whether a food is healthy or not. Like,
and that point is not wrong. But in someone with type 2 diabetes, if they're really going up to 200 every time they eat something, that adds up. And that's what people don't understand. In type 2 diabetes, that does add up. That's time in higher glycemia. They're going to have a higher A1C and a higher GMI, you know, and all that stuff. So, you know, it can be beneficial for them for sure. And there may be something too that they may have significant variability compared to, say, us.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that, when you're looking at a CGM, you're also taking a clinical history, right? It's not like you're just looking at the CGM and not making a patient understand, okay, uh-oh, well, what are you eating? Are you, well, yeah, peanut butter M&Ms are not more healthful than, you know, blueberries or something, even though your glycemic variability may be a little bit
Casey
different.
Would disagree. Dr.
I feel attacked right now. Peanut M&Ms. By the way, peanut M&Ms have a pretty good glycemic index if we're going to go back to glycemic index. But okay, carry on. And they're good for you.
Well, I said peanut butter M&Ms, so I'm not attacking your peanut M&Ms.
Yeah, I know. Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. Well, I think that's pretty good. Now there was, shoot, I was going to make one other point on the, I know. You know, I don't know if you guys have done this. One other group that really benefits where they're not really covered by insurance, and I think they should, are the people with postprandial reactive true hypoglycemia after Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And this might even get into those who have early insulin resistance, prediabetes, because they can have symptomatic, Dr. Tengadu was talking about the Whipple's triad, symptomatic hypoglycemia after eating high processed refined glycemic carbs. And so whether we want to agree with that or not, it happens. And so CGMs, certainly they're now being studied. There are some data, and we anecdotally, Bree, Brett, Artie, I'll bet you guys have had similar. I've had patients with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass hypoglycemia and, you know, kind of that early insulin resistant reactive hypoglycemia do really well on CGM. And I know it's anecdotal, but there's some data coming out and it's going to be studied more. Anybody out there? Everyone's nodding their heads. All right. So I think we're in agreement. Consensus statement. Yes. All right. Anything else? I know we're kind of running out of time. This was probably one of our longer ones, and we're going to have a second episode on CGM. Yes, definitely our longest.
So thanks for listening, everybody. Make sure you give us a 5-star review. If you don't, please don't ever review us, and please like, I'm just kidding. Anyway, subscribe, tell your friends. If you know somebody that's thinking about CGM, send them this. If you're interested in CGMs, let us know what you think. Again, thanks for listening. Here's our outro. Everybody, please stay on.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.